Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you probably heard about Republican presidential candidate John McCain's little joke, singing Bomb Bomb Iran to the tune of the Beach Boys' Barbara Ann. But our guest suggests that that incident wasn't so much a gaffe as a pretty clear illustration of McCain's foreign policy vision. Robert Dreyfus is an independent journalist, one of few who has actually examined McCain's record and his plans on issues of international engagement. We'll hear what he has to say. Also on the show, the number is startling. One in 100 adult Americans is now in jail or prison, according to a new study. But maybe more surprising to some, the researchers say increasing incarceration at tremendous social and economic cost is not increasing public safety. Are media ready to shift the conversation around prisons? We'll hear from Michael Jacobson, director of the Vera Institute of Justice, on that story. And that's coming up, but first, as usual, I'll take a quick look back at some recent press. There's a report on Israel's siege of Gaza in the March 6th issue of Time magazine that manages to compress nearly all the corporate media spin on the crisis into just 350 words. There's the in-passing mention of more than 100 deaths, without explaining that that means more than 100 Palestinian deaths. Then there's the bald assertion that Hamas, quote, doesn't want peace, close quote. That's a simplistic claim that ignores considerable evidence that Hamas is prepared to accept a two-state solution, as Seth Ackerman has documented for Fares Magazine Extra. Then they claimed that Israelis won't tolerate rockets. That overlooks survey data showing majorities of Israelis actually want to engage Hamas peaceably. But perhaps the most treasured myth of reporting on the Israel-Palestine conflict is the idea that the U.S. is playing the role of honest broker trying to bring peace to the region. As Times' Michael Grunewald writes, after noting the dim prospects for a peace agreement, quote, blaming the administration alone for this sad state of affairs is off the mark. It's hard to cure a patient who just doesn't want to be treated, close quote. Yes, and it's also hard to promote peace by arming one faction of the Palestinians and urging it to go to war against the other, which is what the Bush administration did in 2007. You can read that memory hole history also in an article by Seth Ackerman in Extra. You're certainly not likely to be reading about it in Time. A recent article in the New York Times offered a helping hand to the Bush administration's push to legitimize waterboarding as a necessary tool in the so-called war on terror. Reporting on Bush's veto of a bill that would have explicitly prohibited the CIA from using waterboarding, the Times defined the intensely criticized practice as, quote, a technique in which restrained prisoners are threatened with drowning, close quote. Actually, as Judge Evan Wallach, a former judge advocate general, has pointed out, quote, to be effective, waterboarding is usually real drowning that simulates death, close quote. In an op-ed in the Washington Post, Wallach observed that the practice has consistently been defined as torture by U.S. courts. The New York Times should be familiar with this history. It reported on the war crimes convictions of Japanese and North Korean soldiers who used similar techniques against American prisoners of war. In an article on August 6, 1953, the Times reported on American Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Harrison, who had water poured over his face until he agreed to talk to his North Korean interrogators. That story didn't make reference to any threatened drowning. The paper called the practice torture. And finally, like other people, journalists sometimes reveal the most when they're not really thinking about what they're saying. Take Gwen Ifill, host of PBS's Washington Week and senior correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. When Ifill appeared on Meet the Press on March 9th, she was engaged in typical pundit chat, debating the various tactics the Obama and Clinton campaigns would or should or could use against one another. It's just that, along the way, she managed to blithely erase an entire reality. Ifill was questioning Obama's strategy of calling attention to Hillary Clinton's vote for the Iraq invasion, and she said, quote, it's understandable why the Obama people think there is some gain in reminding people that she voted for the war. But I'm beginning to wonder that, absent any bad news out of Iraq, that is something that is useful, close quote. That's right, absent any bad news out of Iraq. That morning's papers carried news of a mass grave unearthed near Bakuba, with perhaps 100 bodies, some of them children. One article in the L.A. Times noted that Iraqis used to associate such mass killings with atrocities under Saddam Hussein's regime, but that in the 5 years since the U.S.-led invasion, mass killings have become a tactic in the sectarian fighting. I'm sure Gwen Ifill would agree that that's bad news. Is it perhaps not bad enough? What would be bad enough? We noted last week that some journalists now feel safe saying it's only lefty media critics who believe the press failed to challenge the run-up to the war. But really, if they can chat about Iraq as a place with no bad news today, how hard is that to believe? You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group. I'll give a little more information about FAIR later on in the program. In CBS's 60 Minutes profile of the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, reporter Scott Pelley stated, "Foreign policy is McCain's specialty." NBC's Brian Williams referred to Senator McCain's vast foreign policy expertise and credibility on national security, and CNN concurs, with correspondent Alan Chernoff noting, "Republicans have to hope that the national discussion turns back to foreign policy. That's where Senator McCain does have an advantage." This taking for granted of McCain's foreign policy credentials certainly favors the candidate, but for something that's considered central to his campaign and his character, John McCain's foreign policy ideas are rarely explored in any great detail, and perhaps that favors him as well, though it doesn't serve the public who are hoping to learn what sort of president he might make. One journalist who has gotten specific about McCain's views on issues of diplomacy and international engagement is Robert Dreyfus. His article, "Hothead McCain," appears in the March 24th issue of The Nation, but it's not the first time he's reported on the politician. Dreyfus is author of "Devil's Game: How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam." He joins us now by phone from Virginia. Welcome back to Counterspin.
Thanks so much. It's always great to be here.
Well, the New York Times on March 5th wondered whether Hillary Clinton could win a wartime election against a, quote, Vietnam hero and national security pro, close quote, like John McCain. It's a throwaway at this point. McCain's credentials in this area are core to the storyline of this election, but in a way they're referred to more than they're really explored. What should we know about John McCain's thoughts on foreign policy versus perhaps what we may have heard?
Well, you know, it's interesting because if you look at the list of people advising McCain, you see everybody from kind of the center-right and the traditional Republican establishment all the way over to many of the real hardcore neocons. But then when you look at what McCain actually says and does and believes, it's almost impossible to find anything in his views and positions that might reflect the realist wing of the Republican Party. He's much, much more in the neocon camp. And someone who seems committed, at least since the mid-1990s, to a much more aggressive, military-dominated foreign policy, one in which he's, I think, instinctively, you know, ready to reach for the armed forces as a way of both solving problems overseas and in projecting America's influence overseas.
So you're talking about somebody who, it's been said, believes in military power as a means more than George W. Bush, which I think might be hard for people to sort of wrap their minds around.
Yeah, and what's scary about it is that it isn't just that his instinct is in the direction of the military, but when you combine that with his temperament, with his, you know, tendency to fly off the hammer, he has a great deal of anger wrapped up inside him, he's very stubborn, he's very hard-headed. A lot of the people I talked to used words like that in describing him. And when you look at some of the specific proposals that he's put forward, mm-hmm. things like a revamped and much more kind of CIA covert operations unit on steroids, for instance, that he wants to model after the World War II OSS, for instance, or this League of Democracies that he wants to create to give international legitimacy to American actions overseas so he can bypass the UN, which often is reluctant to authorize military adventurism as it was in the case of Iraq, for instance, 5 years ago. So in these and other areas, you see McCain beginning to create new institutions that could facilitate a much more aggressive effort to combat what he calls the transcendent threat of radical Islamic extremism. So in other words, he wants to take the war on terror and project it out really decades into the future and create institutions to combat it.
Well, from the press perspective, it seems even if you can sort of make fun of McCain for the hot-headedness and the bomb Iran thing, what you can't challenge is his Vietnam record. That's sacrosanct, even though the country has at least complicated thoughts about the Vietnam War. What's going on there, and what is relevant about his Vietnam history?
Well, you know, you have to start with what he was doing in Vietnam. He was a naval aviator, but he conducted bombing runs over North Vietnam, certainly leading to the deaths of thousands or even tens of thousands of people, I would assume. When he was finally shot down in 1967, he'd carried out several dozen of these raids. And he admitted even to having second thoughts at one point in his Vietnam career. He also came out of the war convinced that American military muscle could have won it if and only if the political constraints had been taken off. So the lesson of Vietnam for Senator McCain is not that it's impossible to fight and win a land war in Asia, or not that it's impossible to defeat a patriotic guerrilla insurgency, but that the U.S. military can do anything and everything if it's, you know, given the authorization to do so. And so he's carried that lesson of Vietnam now way into the future, and certainly he's applied that to Iraq.
Some in the media are openly in awe of John McCain. I mean, Newsweek's Evan Thomas said on Charlie Rose, I mean, who is really going to question John McCain? You know, because as Thomas said, McCain would rather die than dishonor himself and so on. But there's also strategy on the campaign's part. Brian Lizza in The New Yorker wrote about McCain's open access policy with the media as being strategic. He said, quote, by engaging reporters in long, even substantive conversations, he also disarms them. The incentive to ask gotcha questions that feed the latest news cycle is greatly reduced, and the hours of exposure to McCain breed a relationship that inclines journalists to be more careful about describing the context of his statements, close quote. Would you say that reporters who are on the bus, if you will, with McCain are disarmed by the access? And is that what we're looking for in journalists?
You know, I can't explain why they have the reaction they do. I rode around the bus with McCain back in 1999, 2000 in New Hampshire. I watched this incestuous thing happen in front of my disbelieving eyes. People joking and laughing and talking about the Army-Navy football game. And, you know, McCain answers every question and eventually reporters kind of run out of their questions, and then they just start gossiping and talking and laughing, and they become, you know, part of the family. And I found it extremely upsetting. During those bus rides, I once asked a very challenging question, and you could hear a pin drop. People were like looking at me like, what is this guy doing here, you know, spoiling the party? And it was a question about sugar subsidies or something very minor, but something I had been doing some work on at the time about how we subsidize the price of sugar. And you know, even on things like that, people just buy into McCain. I think it's very troubling the way the media has laid down for McCain without really, I think, letting people know that this guy does have some real anger management problems, and he has some real policies that are quite scary. And as I said earlier, when you put those two things together, I find the prospect of McCain in the White House to be very frightening. I don't think that's shared by most reporters. I think most reporters, once they get to know McCain, kind of put all those concerns under the rug, and he starts to become this, you know, joking, laughing man that they've ridden around the bus with. And I think it does the public a disservice.
We've been speaking with independent journalist Robert Dreyfus. His most recent article, Hothead McCain, appears in the March 24th issue of The Nation. Thanks very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure, always.
When it comes to crime and criminal justice, conversations can get murky fast. There are moral issues involved. A lot of hard-to-pin-down values, social and personal, come into play. Let's just say the debate around causes of crime or responses to it rarely seems data-driven. A new report on prisons from the Pew Center on the States seems to call for anchoring talk about incarceration in practical terms, asking whether current U.S. policy is really delivering the social goals it's ostensibly designed to achieve. The report is garnering press attention for the number that serves as a stark illustration of the situation. 1 in 100 adult Americans is now in prison or jail. That leaves any other nation in the world far behind. Joining us now to discuss the new study and where it fits in what we know about crime and prisons is Michael Jacobson, director of the Vera Institute of Justice here in New York. Jacobson served as New York City Correction Commissioner and also as the city's probation commissioner in the 1990s. He's author of the book Downsizing Prisons, How to Reduce Crime and End Mass Incarceration. Welcome to Counterspin, Michael Jacobson.
Well, thanks for having me.
I think there are a number of misunderstandings and fallacies in our public conversation about crime and punishment, and one response to this Pew report seems to contain a central one. The New York Post stated it very boldly in their March 3rd editorial, headlined, "Packed Prisons and Low Crime," in which they said, quote, "Complaints don't take into account what surely is clear to most Americans. There is a direct connection between the all-time high in the nation's prison population and the fact that the nation is enjoying its lowest crime rates in nearly half a century. For all the complaints about the cost of long-term incarceration, it stands to reason that if the bad guys are behind bars and stay there for the full term of their sentences, they won't be free on the streets to live a life of crime, plain and simple." Close quote. Is it that plain and that simple?
No, and while that's a sort of attractive and in some ways intuitive argument, it also happens to be totally wrong. And it's wrong for a number of reasons, but interestingly, especially given that the New York Post is in New York, what's interesting about New York State is that New York State, in fact, has the fastest declining prison system in the country. That system has declined by about 14% in terms of the number of prisoners there over the last decade. And yet, New York State leads the country in crime decline. And the same is true on a local level. New York City jails have decreased more than any other big city jail in the country. And New York City leads the nation in crime decline. So clearly, the New York example sort of puts the lie to the general thought that in order to drive crime down, you have to put more and more and more people into prison for longer and longer periods of time. It's not true, both because the research says it isn't true, but it's also not true because nowhere is that more obvious than in the state of New York, where populations of prisoners are down and crime is down more than any place else in the United States of America.
Well, I should note that it wasn't just the New York Post. The New York Times, in their write-up, presented Paul Castle, a law professor at the University of Utah and a former federal judge, who said that the Pew Report overlooked the very tangible benefits of lower crime rates. And he said, quote, "1 out of every 100 adults is behind bars because 1 out of every 100 adults has committed a serious criminal offense," close quote.
Yeah, and that's also wrong. And it's wrong because while there are people who have committed serious offenses behind bars, and they absolutely belong behind bars, I mean, they're, you know, prisons should exist and people who present a threat to public safety should be in them. The problem is that the United States over the last 20 and 30 years has put more and more and more people in prison who don't pose a threat to public safety and who could be better supervised in the community or by getting drug treatment or by getting job training. So the problem has been that as we put more and more non-serious offenders in prison and spend more and more money on them in prison and more money on them when they come out of prison because they simply get worse when they're in prison, that serves to take away money that we could be using for a variety of other programs that could decrease crime even more. So, you know, it's not true that prisons are only full of serious offenders. There are serious offenders in prison. There are a bunch, you know, 30, 40% in some states, in some states 60% of people in prison who have not committed any kind of violent crime. And even for a lot of those folks, you know, you can commit a violent crime when you're 20. But once you're 67 years old and you're on dialysis in prison, you're really not a threat to public safety anymore either. So it's a very facile argument, but it's not supported by the facts.
I think there's also an implication that at least the Times didn't draw out there from this gentleman's comment, which suggests that the high U.S. incarceration rate just means that Americans are just more criminal than people in other countries, since other countries don't have that same kind of rate. But I guess it would also follow that the groups that are statistically overrepresented in prisons, blacks and Hispanics, for example, they're just more criminal than other groups.
Right. And, you know, one of the biggest problems with our system is not just the sheer enormity of it, not just the fact that we spend $60 billion a year on prisons, and as a result, we get a 52% recidivism rate. That is, more than 5 out of 10 people who leave prison are back in prison within 3 years. That's not an outcome that anyone should be particularly pleased with. But our prisons are disproportionately filled with people of color. And there's, you know, a number of real and possible reasons for that. But whatever the explanation is, it's a huge social problem. And one of the latest figures from the U.S. Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Statistics, is that if you're a black male baby born in this country today, unless current rates change, you have almost 1 in 3 chance of spending some time in prison in your lifetime. And that is a disgrace, and it cannot stand, and it shouldn't be allowed to stand. So it's not like prisons only protect public safety. They do serve a very important public safety function. But if we overuse prisons, which we do, then it can cause a variety of collateral consequences that in the end will cause more crime than it prevents.
I heard Adam Gelb from Pew say that they think that prisons can reduce crime. It's just that a lot of other things do, too. And part of what they hope to do was to turn the conversation to some of those other things that you would be talking about if, as a society, you were really talking about securing public safety and building healthier communities as opposed to merely punishing bad people. What are some of those less talked about things?
Yeah, and that's absolutely correct. You know, as a nation, we have defaulted to prison as the automatic way we want to handle people who break the law. And as I said, for a lot of people who break the law, that's perfectly appropriate. But we know, for instance, that increasing high school graduation rates, for instance, will have a much greater effect on public safety, on reducing crimes and reducing victims, than putting tens of thousands of low-level drug dealers in prison, for example. We know that providing job training, vocational training, education in prison, for example, community-based alternatives, all will have a greater public safety impact than just expanding our prison system, let's say, even by 1 or 2%, right? The benefits of doing that are not remotely worth the costs, when for less money, we know the research says the results are in. You can get more public safety by doing a variety of things that are based in the community, some programmatic and some sanctions. The problem has been getting over the politics of crime and the sort of intuitive attractiveness of those kinds of arguments that you quoted before, that you have to put the bad guys behind bars. Because we now know, it's not conjecture, it's not supposition, it's not hypothetical. We know that there are a variety of things that, from a pure public safety point of view, from the point of view of having less crime and less victims, there are a host of things that will work better than simply putting more people in prison for longer. We have so many people in prison now that the marginal benefits of putting even more in and keeping them marginally longer is not remotely worth the cost. And there's really very little expert debate about that now.
Well, finally, a lot of the media reports on the Pew 1 in 100 study seemed fairly nuanced and uninflammatory. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch had a headline, "Tough but Not Smart," which struck me as the kind of thing you just probably would not have read in the not long ago time of super predators and gangbangers. In the 1980s and 90s, tough but not smart, I don't think was even an allowable critique of policy, not even a coherent one. Tough was smart. Do you think the conversation is changing? And is that just because there's some pushback from the states on this?
I think the conversation is changing. And I think one of the things that the Pew Report tried to do was look at a few states very specifically where the conversation is changing. So you take a state like Texas, right? A big conservative, very tough on crime state, huge prison system, long sentences, leads the country in the number of people it puts to death through the death penalty. But Texas has decided, right, they've made a sort of statewide decision that they can no longer want to maintain such a huge prison system at such huge cost when their policymakers have now been convinced that they can drive crime down faster by investing, in Texas's case, $500 million in other sorts of initiatives. And again, you're right, you know, 10 years ago, that just would have never happened. But I think we're at the point now where one is that states can no longer afford to maintain these monstrously huge and growing systems. And two, where, you know, enough people are talking about evidence-based programs, where the research is sort of out, where policy experts generally agree that we've reached a point where you can start to shrink these systems, where you can redirect money and get more public safety. If people are really interested in public safety and protecting their residents and having less victims, and you're less interested in just accumulating political capital by building more and more prisons, if your interest is in protecting your citizens, the voters, the people who live in this country, then we won't keep doing what we're doing because we know it doesn't work, and in many cases, it's harmful.
I'd like to thank you very much for joining us. We've been speaking with Michael Jacobson, director of the Vera Institute of Justice and author of Downsizing Prisons, How to Reduce Crime and End Mass Incarceration. Thanks so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Well, thanks, and thanks again for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.